This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Welcome to the Trumpet's weekly review of all the important news. I'm Jeremiah Jacques, filling in for Mr. Joel Hilliker today. And with me is our panel. Here in the studio, we have Andrew Miller.
Hello.
And Rufaro Manyepa.
Hello.
And joining us from our office in the UK is Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And Mihailo Zekic.
Hello.
Well, the Biden administration is in the midst of a major realignment of the U.S. military, and it's accomplishing this, at least at this phase, by pulling troops and all kinds of armaments out of the Middle East. To bring us up to speed on this, we'll go to Mihailo Zekic.
Yeah, on June 18th, the Wall Street Journal published a story covering a series of American withdrawals from the Middle East, and they're pretty significant. Normally, when we hear withdrawal, we think of, you know, taking all the troops off the ground and sending the boys back home and that sort of thing. In this case, it's not so much American soldiers per se, but it's American defense systems from several Arab states, some of whom are quite significant allies of America. These include countries like Saudi Arabia, Iraq, Kuwait, Jordan. The bulk of the withdrawal will concern about 8 Patriot anti-missile battery systems. Also, from Saudi Arabia specifically, the Terminal High Altitude Area Defense System, or THAAD, will also be withdrawn from Saudi Arabia. And several jet fighter squadrons in the Middle East will also have their numbers reduced as well. Now, we don't have too many details as to where these systems will be going. The Pentagon hasn't announced too much, only that they're leaving the Middle East. Some people suspect that they might be relocated, say, to Guam to counter China. Others think that they might be brought over to Eastern Europe or somewhere around there to check on Russia. They could very well be just sent back to the United States. We're not exactly sure. But this is a very significant move, considering how significant Saudi Arabia and some of these other countries are in allies with America. Saudi Arabia holds American military bases, so does Kuwait. Iraq, of course, American troops have been on the ground there for quite some time. And so it really shows the Biden administration's determination to de-engage from the region.
So what can you tell us about the Biden administration's motivation for this region-wide withdrawal?
Well, that's the thing. They haven't really said too much. In one sense, under the Biden administration and under the Trump administration, there's been a general policy of trying to disentangle America from the Middle East. But with the Biden administration specifically, this is going in the context of the negotiations for a nuclear deal with Iran in Vienna. Now, of course, Biden, who was vice president under Barack Obama, the Obama administration signed the nuclear deal. President Trump pulled out of that. And now Biden and his associates are desperate to do whatever it takes to get Iran back to the nuclear negotiating table. And Biden and his administration have demonstrated that in a number of ways, even to the point where they would throw traditional American allies under the bus. For example, a few months ago, then Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was scheduled to visit the United Arab Emirates, who just recently made relations with Israel. And Washington got in the way and pressured the Emiratis to cancel the meeting. Or, for example, another example, the Americans pressured the Saudis and the Emiratis to disengage from Yemen and the civil war going there. The Arab coalition was the only major opponent of the Houthi rebels there, who are backed by Iran. And now that the Saudis are gone there, the Houthis basically have no major enemy and can cause a lot of more problems there than before. And this disengagement, Saudi Arabia is one of the major foes of Iran, adversaries in the region. And this demonstrates another undermining of some of those enemies of Iran in order to placate it and to help it be coaxed into negotiating with the United States.
So we've already seen the U.S. withdraw from Afghanistan. That won't be totally completed until September of this year, but it's much more further advanced than these other withdrawals from Saudi Arabia and things like that. So it may give us a bit of a blueprint for what we can expect in the other countries. What can you tell us about how that withdrawal from Afghanistan is going so far?
Disastrously. That's basically the one word summary of it. It won't be a complete withdrawal. There'll be a few hundred troops remaining to protect like diplomats and the Kabul airport and whatnot. But as far as an actual military mission there, it's basically gone. And the Taliban has been receiving an absolute resurgence. They've announced that they've estimated that they've taken over about 80% of the country, and they had already had quite a bit of significant amount of territory before America even announced withdrawing. But they're taking more and more control away from the central government in Kabul, and a lot of analysts are expecting that Kabul could even fall within a few months once the disengagement is complete. And that's little Afghanistan, when not to say that America is completely disengaging at this point from Saudi Arabia or wherever, but what happens when Islamists try to take advantage, what happens when the Houthis see that the Saudis' missile defense systems are gone? They've already launched rockets into Saudi Arabia. What happens when the Shiite militias see that America is disengaging from Iraq? We can very well see very similar insurgencies like in Afghanistan in these parts of the world as well.
So from events like this, we can see that the days of the United States being a major power in the Middle East are coming to an end. And that's exactly what we at the Trumpet would expect.
Oh, very much so. This actually ties in with several really important trends that we've been watching for quite a while. Actually, our Jerusalem correspondent, Brent Noctegal, wrote in the March 2019 issue of our print magazine an article, America is Backing Out, which covers this all pretty well. It ties in specifically with a prophecy in Daniel chapter 11, verse 40, that talks about two end-time blocks, the king of the south and the king of the north. The king of the south will push at the king of the north, and the king of the north will come against him like a whirlwind and utterly obliterate him. We've talked about this prophecy many times. Our editor-in-chief has written a lot about this, Mr. Gerald Plury, and how the king of the south represents Iran, and the king and a radical Islamist bloc behind them, and the king of the north represents a united Europe that goes to counterattack them. And it's interesting, as Mr. Noctegal brings out in that article, you look at Daniel 11, verse 40, America is nowhere to be found in the picture. It's not even part of the equation. Iran today calls America the great Satan and everything like that, but that's America, of course, is halfway around the world. Once it's gone out of the Middle East, it won't really be that much important. Europe is the next big Western power, and that's close by, and it's even closer than America. So this shows that America is going to leave the Middle East. B, it's going to show that Iran is going to rise up a lot more powerful than it is now. And if you combine that with another prophecy in Psalm 83, which talks about various Arab countries and Muslim countries in the Middle East allying with Europe and Germany, it shows that once America's gone, well, who else is going to protect the modern Arabs? They're even more terrified of Iran than America is. They're going to need a protector. And Germany, as we've written about in our literature, as our editor-in-chief has talked about so much, is going to be the one to fill that void.
America is Backing Out is the name, once again, of that article by Brent Noctegal. And we will include a link to that in our show notes. Well, thanks very much for that, Mihailo. We'll take a look now at Hong Kong, where tears were shed yesterday after the famous Apple Daily newspaper, the territory's most pro-democracy newspaper, published its final issue. To learn about why this happened and the significance of it, we'll go to Rifaro Manyepa.
Yes, after 26 years of operation, the Apple Daily, as you said, Hong Kong's preeminent pro-democracy newspaper, published its final edition yesterday. In fact, its pro-democracy and thus anti-China messaging made it highly unpopular in Beijing. And it's been under pressure for years, ever since it was established, but it continued on regardless with its pro-democracy messaging. But ever since China came out with its national security law around a year ago, it's really been cracking down on any and every form of democracy. And this axing of the Apple Daily is basically the latest such instance of this happening. Just this last week, Hong Kong authorities froze company assets from the Apple Daily. They seized journalists' computers. They charged two of its top executives under the national security law as well. And all of this was also combined with the fact that employees were no longer completely safe because of the raids that Beijing was doing on the premises of the Apple Daily. And so its management decided that on Thursday, yesterday, it would stop updating its website and it would run its last print edition. Hundreds of journalists who would have lost their jobs had actually already quit because they were afraid of what the authorities were going to do to them because of this new national security law. And Sharon Fast, who's a journalism lecturer at the University of Hong Kong, said, "The era of free political speech as we have long known it is gone." This was absolutely huge for free speech. The Apple Daily itself was established in 1995, which was 2 years before the handover from the UK. And ever since then, it's been among the most widely read publications in Hong Kong. It's aggressive reporting on politics in Hong Kong and on the Chinese Communist Party made it really resonant with readers. And even though over the years, so many other readers and so many other media rivals moved politically towards Beijing in order to be viewed favorably by Beijing, the Apple Daily didn't. It stayed outspoken in pushing for democracy, and it aligned itself with the majority of the people in Hong Kong who supported opposition parties and opposed China and what it was doing. In 2019, for example, when the protests against China and its encroachment came into Hong Kong, the Apple Daily actually used its front page to call on people and to mobilize the public to join in these anti-government protests. And all over its newsrooms, it was decorated with protest-related posters and memorabilia like that. And so Hong Kong officials lately have charged the Apple Daily with being a tool to challenge national security and to overall bring instability in the nation. And so that's what resulted in the raiding of its newsroom. Its founder, Jimmy Lai, was actually arrested a few months ago, as we reported at the Trumpet. And then this past week, as we've mentioned already, all the raidings happened and dozens of computers from the newsroom were thrown and destroyed. And so it was forced to shut down.
So this really shows that the days of Hong Kong's semi-autonomy and its press freedom that it enjoyed for so many years are over. And this attack by China, it's only the latest since those national security laws have been implemented. Could you talk about some of the other attacks that have happened before this?
Right, exactly. As I said earlier, there was the attack and the jailing of protesters in the streets. Soon after that, high-profile democracy activists were arrested. That was last year in April for their role in the protests. A few months later, in November, China ousted four pro-democracy lawmakers from the Hong Kong legislature, which was a huge move, basically showing that they only wanted people who would be loyal to China in the governing body of Hong Kong. They went on to track and shut down social media accounts and content. Now, at this stage, we see that the media itself is no longer free. And there have even been moves to censor books, art, movies, and music all in the city. And it started very slowly, but you can see where we are now. And Bruce Liu, a journalism lecturer at the Hong Kong Baptist University, said that Apple Daily had served as a barometer of Hong Kong's high degree of autonomy guaranteed for 50 years after the handover in 1997. The Apple Daily had used itself as an experiment to test the limits, and it has been shown that it will not succeed.
Would you be able to place this in the context of Bible prophecy for us and just let the listeners know what they could read to better understand that?
Yeah, this is exactly what Mr. Fleury has been talking about in regards to the times of the Gentiles. He refers to that because Jesus Christ spoke of it in Luke 21, verse 24. And Mr. Fleury explains that the Gentiles in Bible prophecy are presented in contrast to the Israelites. Now, while Israel refers to mainly the United States and Britain, the Gentiles refer to the non-Israelite peoples. And Bible prophecy shows that as modern Israelite nations decline, Gentile nations such as China will become the dominant world powers. And we can see that for the last 300 years, America and Britain stood as the pinnacles of freedom and overall world stability. We see that even in the fact that the Apple Daily was established during the time of Britain's rule in the last 2 years of Britain's rule over Hong Kong. But over the years, especially since the handover from Britain to China, Hong Kong's freedoms have slowly been eroded. And that's exactly what this era, what these times of the Gentile represent, and what's going to be happening even more as we approach those times more fully in Bible prophecy.
Raffaro has a new article about this Apple Daily shutdown that will be going up on thetrumpet.com soon, so please keep an eye out for that. And we'll also include a link in our show notes for today's episode to Mr. Fleury's article that he mentioned there. It's called What Are the Times of the Gentiles? And it really gives a thorough explanation of that prophecy. Well, thanks very much for that, Raffaro. For the next story, we'll take a look at a French politician who the Vatican just put on the path to sainthood. To learn about this and what it tells us about the Vatican and Europe, we'll go to Richard Palmer.
Yes, it is not every day that you see the Vatican making someone a saint. And with all the news about Matthew Hancock and Gina Carangelo, I believe her name is, hitting the news, you can see why. But the Vatican is looking at one particular former French prime minister and putting him on the path to sainthood. I think the last time a politician was made a saint was Sir Thomas More, who opposed Henry VIII's marriage to Anne Boleyn. That was all the way back, well, 1535 was when he died. He was made a saint in 1935. So it's a pretty rare circumstance. But last Saturday, Pope Francis recognized the, quote, heroic virtues of the French Prime Minister Robert Schuman. And this is the opening gun, really, of the Vatican process to sainthood. More the first milestone, I should say, on the road to sainthood. So now for him to become a full saint, the Catholic Church needs to recognize two miracles from him. So who is this rare politician on the path to sainthood? Well, Robert Schuman is one of the so-called founding fathers of the European Union. His Schuman plan proposed the European Coal and Steel Community, which was that was designed right from the start to kind of be the small beginning of a European superstate. Okay, transforming Europe, this country that has just been fighting it, or this continent that has been divided by war during World War II, into a superstate, that's a big task. So Schuman put forward to this plan of, okay, let's just start with a union that focus on trading in two important commodities, coal and steel, and then we'll ratchet it up from there. But what this announcement does really is it shines a strong light on the way that these European founding fathers were really acting and inspired to act by their Catholic religion. Just about every one of Europe's founding fathers was a Catholic and saw the push for the European Union as part of their religious duty. And Schuman was certainly one of those. There were others, Germany's leader Konrad Adenauer, you had Di Gillespie in Italy, you had a number, Robert Henry Speck, I think it was, from Belgium. But they were all Catholic and they all saw that playing a key role in their desire to form this type of European superstate.
So the Catholic Church has long been a big proponent of European unity and has made many pushes like this over the years. What can you tell us about what's behind that?
Yeah, so this is something that the Catholic Church has consistently gotten behind. This is something that popes very traditionally supported. You know, Pope John Paul III or Pope John the 13th saying Catholics should be in the front ranks of those supporting the European Union. Pope Paul the 6th saying that the Catholic Church has made Europe. It is our mission as bishops basically to push this forwards. In 1962, Britain's Topic magazine wrote, "The Vatican, usually cautious over political changes not of its own inspiration, now considers the common market the work of divine providence. Not since the time of Spain's Charles V has a Roman Catholic political force been so strongly wielded. Not since the end of the Holy Roman Empire has the Vatican been offered a Catholic rallying point like the common market. If the Pact of Rome, which created the common market, had been signed within the Vatican's walls, it could not have favored the church more." This is something that they have pushed for very strongly. And it's something where it is hard, I think, to understand exactly why, and to understand why some of these devout Catholics wanted this so much without Bible prophecy. I mean, it is something that... well-meaning people kind of disagree on both sides. Why has there been such continual Catholic support for this? And when you bring the Bible into that, it really does make sense of this, and it does make this an important story and a story that is really worth covering. So the Bible talks about, in Revelation chapter 17, it talks about this empire being led by a church. It talks about a beast ridden by a woman. This is symbolism. A beast is symbolism from an empire. You can see that in Daniel chapter 2 and in Daniel chapter 7. And then the woman is symbolic of a church. So the Bible told us there would be this church dominating a European continent. And that's what we see again and again. And God foretold this in huge amounts of detail thousands and thousands of years ago. And then he revealed that truth. Herbert W. Armstrong specifically forecast that you would have this European Union. He talked about the way that European politicians would try to get this European Union together on their own without the Catholic Church, and they would fail. And that's what we've seen continually. You know, I think they haven't given the Catholic Church the role that the Catholic Church would have wanted in this union, and they haven't completed this union yet. It won't be complete until the Catholic Church has that predominant role. So, revealed prophecy informed his forecast on Europe. We've seen so many of those forecasts fulfilled already. We have seen subsequent, he was talking about this in 1945. We then saw all of these Catholics in the form of Robert Schuman and others, and Paul Henry Speck and these others come along and push this forwards. We've seen popes encourage it. We're just waiting for it to be fully completed. But it is absolute confirmation that what we're looking at is the truth of the Bible. And this is all coming and happening in accordance of a plan laid out in the Bible in revelation from God the Father.
Richard has an article up on the website right now about this push for sainthood. We will be sure to include a link to that in our show notes for today's program. Thanks very much for that, Richard. We'll take a look now at the United States, where the Biden administration has called on Congress to adopt some strict gun control legislation. For this, we'll go to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, as America pulls out from wars in the Middle East, some warlike conditions are ramping up right here at home. Ever since the George Floyd protests started last summer, the murder rate in America's cities has increased dramatically, to the point where an average of 55 people are being shot to death every day now, compared to about 45 a day for the 3 or 4 year period before that. And so it's got people's attention. And on Wednesday, Joe Biden and Attorney General Garland came out and talked a bit about the rising crime rate and put out their proposal to stop it, which was to increase strict gun control across America. Biden's speech, actually, he was very disparaging of the Second Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, which is a guarantee that since a well-regulated militia is essential to the security of any free state, the right of the people shall not be infringed. he basically came out and said, he said, if you want to take on the government, you're going to need an F-15 or maybe some nuclear weapons. And then went on to infer that, like, the point is you can't take on the government with guns anyway, so you might as well just let us regulate them. And then he went on to propose a series of regulations. I mean, he talked about red flag laws, which would let a family member or a police officer petition a court to bar anyone they think is mentally unstable from owning a weapon. He talked about barring a pistol braces that let you use a pistol like a rifle. But probably the most significant proposal that came out of this Wednesday's speech was a government proposal to have a zero tolerance policy for any gun store that violates federal law. They're like, if you sell a gun to someone who federal law says shouldn't be able to own a gun, first instance, you lose your license, which doesn't sound like a horrible law. Like I said, if you're violating federal law to take away your license. But then the context is you've got to decide is that there's quite a bit of gray area between whether a gun store is violating federal law or state law, because a lot of these Biden proposals about banning pistol braces and putting red flags on certain people are federal laws making certain types of guns illegal that the states say are okay. And so when you're getting the kind of like the showdown between the federal government and the states over what guns are you allowed to own.
So it sounds like this could really have the makings of a bit of a showdown between states versus, you know, the federal law there.
Yeah, it's almost kind of like a Civil War style fight over states' rights in some ways, because they've got the federal government on one hand saying that we want to input these new laws for all states to follow, and then several state and local governments have really taken exception to that. A couple notable examples here is in Utah, there's 29 counties in Utah, and each county has a sheriff, and all 29 county sheriffs have come out and signed an open letter saying that they outright refuse to enforce any federal law that violates the Second Amendment, or right of the people to keep and bear arms. I've got a quote actually from that letter here. It says, "With our fellow Utahns, we recognize the Constitution not only as the founding document that establishes the structure of our government, but in regard to the Bill of Rights, it is the guarantor of individual rights and the limiter of federal power. The Constitution is the supreme law of the land, and all legislation and government actions must comply with it. Importantly, the Second Amendment of our divinely inspired Constitution clearly states, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. We hereby recognize a significant principle underlying the Second Amendment. The right to keep and bear arms is indispensable to the existence of a free people." And that's all 29 sheriffs in Utah basically saying that they won't enforce any federal law that violates that amendment. And there's 9 other states that actually at the state legislature level have passed laws basically saying the same thing, even penalizing local law enforcement for enforcing some of these policies Biden's trying to make them enforce. Missouri comes to mind as one of the big ones, where the governor basically signed a law imposing a $50,000 fine on any local police agency that violates a person's Second Amendment rights, or I guess more specifically violates state law. Basically in the showdown where you've now got the Department of Justice saying that like any gun dealer that violates these new proposals that Biden's put in place will lose their gun dealing license. And then you have the state coming in and saying that, well, any law enforcement agency that enforces what the federal government just told them to enforce will be fined. And so now if you're a local police officer in Missouri, you've kind of got to decide, like, well, who am I going to follow? Am I going to follow my state government, or am I going to follow the federal government? Probably if they're smart, they'll follow the state government because they're the one who writes their salary check.
So quite a lot of opposition there at the state level. But if these proposals were to pass, is there evidence that they could reduce crime?
I don't think so. I guess when you look at the crime rates in the United States, like, 68% of the murders, like 2/3 of the murders, happen in 5% of the counties. And even then, most of the murders happen in certain small districts of those counties. So, like, even though America's murder rate's going up and is high compared to the rest Western nations, there's very few small pockets with just these astronomically high murder rates that's bringing up the national average. And the thing about all those pockets where the murder rate's really high and bringing up the average is they already have all the strict gun control laws that the Democrats want them to have. So I guess Biden's argument is that, like, well, we need to crack down on the conservative rural states and make them adopt the same strict gun control laws that aren't working in the big cities. And I guess the logic is like, well, these criminals in the cities must be going out to country Bass Pro Shops and getting arms and trafficking them in there. So it's like, well, if we take the guns away from everyone or outlaw these guns everywhere, they won't be able to get in these inner city zones. I think that probably most of these gangs and drug cartels that are doing most of the murders in these high murder areas in the cities would be able to find a source of arms other than a hunting store out in the country. But the bigger issue here does get back to the purpose of the Second Amendment that Joe Biden alluded to, saying that he obviously understands that the founders put the Second Amendment in place to stop a tyrannical government from rising up, because he said, well, you can't overthrow the government unless you have nukes or F-15. So basically saying that, like, well, since the founders' times, the government's gotten so much more powerful than private gun owners that you might as well just give up and do whatever Washington says.
Could you place this in the context of Bible prophecy for us and just let the listeners know what they could read to better understand that?
Right. Well, I mentioned briefly earlier about, like, Civil War-like conditions, because, I mean, now you've got state government saying one thing and federal government saying another thing, and that you've got divided loyalties where local police officers, local gun stores, local people have to decide basically which law they're going to follow. Are they going to follow the Constitution? Are they going to follow what their governor says? Are they going to follow what Washington says? And this really is leading to Civil War-like conditions. And we've got an article we'll put in the show notes that I wrote yesterday entitled Republican States Ban Police from Enforcing Federal Gun Laws, that really points to some comments our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Flory, has made about Republicans really underestimating what they're dealing with. In his article, Saving America from the Radical Left Temporarily, he writes, "The mindset behind the radical Democrats is exposed when you look at their handling of another issue, gun control. Every time there's a school shooting, even before the facts about the situation come out, they immediately began pushing for gun bans. After the most recent shooting, they funded student groups and encouraged students to revolt against authorities. They don't just want to raise the buying age or to restrict the sale of a few types of guns. They want to eliminate all guns. They hate the Second Amendment, and they want to destroy the Constitution." And he's bringing out in that article that I'm sure there are some well-meaning Democrats who sincerely believe that these gun control laws will help reduce crime. But there is also a radical fringe in the Democratic Party that is pushing for more and more socialist policies, recognizes the fact that a lot of the conservative states don't want these socialist policies. They're not going to go along with them willingly. They'll have to be forced. And you can't force someone to do something if, like, they have a well-armed population of people ready to stand up. And so if you've got two sides forming, neither side's going to back down. And like I said, the only way this is going to end is in you start using those guns in warlike conditions, which is exactly what the Bible prophesies in verses like Ezekiel 5 and verse 12, that talks about a third of the population of end-time American Britain dying from pestilence, famine, and violence. And in Mr. Fleury's book, Ezekiel, the End Time Prophet, he really talks at that term pestilence, even though we think of it more like disease or pandemics. It really just means death and destruction, and the type of context of that verse is showing, like, civil war. A civil war so devastating that it kills 100 million people. It was pretty sobering, because it's in that article we put in the show notes, I bring up the role gun control played in the Bolshevik Revolution, And then that was a devastating civil war that killed 10 million people, one of the deadliest things that's happened in human history. But 100 million, that's like 10 times worse than the Bolshevik revolution is what Ezekiel's talking about when he's talking about civil war in America. And yeah, this gun control is one of the most contentious issues that driving a wedge between people in America today.
Andrew's article up on thetrumpet.com right now, once again, is called Republican States Ban Police from Enforcing Federal Gun Laws. So you can find that on thetrumpet.com, and we will also link to it in our show notes for today's episode. And then we will also link to Communism in America Today by Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury. A very important read there. Thanks very much for that, Andrew. We'll take a quick break now, and when we come back, we'll talk about the EU's new cyber unit, Russia's support of Myanmar, plans in the US for a digital dollar, and the latest on the conflict in Libya. We'll be right back.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
Cyber attacks are on the rise, and they're not just being waged against the U.S., but against nations and organizations around the world. And this week, the European Union established a new mechanism to fight back against these attacks. For this, we'll go once again to Richard.
Yes, I think you make a good point when you talk about nations around the world are being hit by cyber attacks. Nations are looking at ways to respond. Here we have the European Union looking to set up a joint cyber unit, once again responding as if it were a nation. This is typically the kind of thing that you would see governments doing. So the European Commission on June 23rd, a couple of days ago, they laid out their plans to build a new joint cyber unit. And this would cover all kind of, quote, cyber incidents. So you'd be looking at cybercrime and fraud and the more low-level kind of things. But then, as we've seen in the United States, that a lot of this cyber incidents can range to things much higher than that, and things that really even more border on to an act of war or potentially even terrorism. So them pushing for a joint cyber unit is, again, a big step towards the military of the European and towards a European super state. If you think about how a nation is going to, or the threats that face countries today, cyber warfare is a big one. And having a combined cyber response is on its way to having a combined military or a combined wing of the military or a combined police force. Then you kind of bring in, well, what can some kind of joint cyber command do? I think we're all more aware now of just how much personal information we put out on the internet, how much any kind of credible online organization can find out about any individual. And so then to have the European Union setting up their own joint cyber unit. So again, how much information are they going to hold on their citizens? I mean, they are focused more on monitoring crime, but of course, we've seen that drift more and more into pre-crime or potential crime in a whole host of other areas. But I think what strikes me most of all about this is we've been talking about, and Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury has been talking about cyber warfare for quite a long time. He was writing about it all the way back in the 90s, where there were a handful of people warning about cyber warfare, but not a huge number. Now you can't ignore it. It is everywhere. And one thing, though, that has been unique and is still unique from the angle that Mr. Fleury's been talking about is he is focused on not Russia's cyber warfare, not China's cyber warfare, but Germany and Europe, but really a German-led Europe and their cyber warfare. And this really exposes, I think, and highlights what is different about our coverage here at The Trumpet. It's not informed by our understanding of technology. It's informed by our understanding of the Bible. And Mr. Fleury's initial kind of article about cyber warfare was focused on verses in the Bible, in the book of Ezekiel chapter 7, that has a prophecy that could very easily be describing the results of cyber warfare. It says they've blown the trumpet even to make all ready, but none goes to the battle. And Mr. Flurry writes, the trumpet of war is to be blown in Israel, mainly America and Britain. It seems everybody is expecting our people to go to the battle, but the greatest tragedy imaginable occurs. Nobody goes to battle, even though the trumpet is blown. Will it be because of computer terrorism? But right from then, he talked about and focused on Germany's potential to do this. Now, just about everybody who is anybody in Britain or in America or in the security establishment absolutely trusts Germany. I think to a lot of people, it feels completely crazy even to question whether there could be any kind of attack or cyber attack from Germany or any kind of German enmity to the United States. But the Bible tells us, and you look at the identities of various different nations described in the Bible, and you can see that there is a prophecy of a surprise attack coming at Britain, coming at America from Germany. Now, I think the most savvy experts can see that there's a parting of the ways between America and Germany right now. We've had Blinken visiting Germany at the moment, and there's talk about repairing this relationship, but it's becoming clearer and clearer that these two are going into different areas. Germany is siding with Russia. Germany is siding with China. So there are some that are starting to see that. But because this forecast was informed by the Bible, Mr. Flurry was focusing on the potential for Germany to carry out this attack. He was looking at Germany's history as well, their potential for cyber attack. And that article, or at least one, I think this is the latest version of it, is called America's Achilles Heel and Germany. That one's from the May 2005 Trumpet Print magazine. So he really did focus on Europe, focus on Germany because of what the Bible says. And now you see Europe getting more involved in the cyber domain, trying to come up with its own joint cyber unit. It is early days for this cyber unit at the moment. It is a plan. It's a proposal. So it's not something that is going to be in action tomorrow morning. But when you look at what the Bible says and what we've said based on those forecasts, it really makes a lot of sense to be paying attention to what is happening here, and that this kind of European, you know, for Europe to develop these kind of cyber capabilities. I had another article as well, and just the latest Trumpet Print, cyber attacks expose our fragile world, just talking about how these cyber attacks could tie into a whole number of different Bible prophecies. You know, the Bible has a lot to talk about people dying as just society breaks down and America's cut off from world trade, and cyber warfare could really play a major role in that. So over the last few months, you've talked about it on this show, Jeremiah. I've talked about it a bit as well. We've got a good hard look at what a cyber attack can do. And so, of course, Europe has got to be concerned about that as well as the United States. But when you bring Bible prophecy into the picture, you can see that America should be concerned about what Europe's doing here as well.
We will include a link to Richard's article, Cyber Attacks Expose Our Fragile World, in the show notes for today's program. And we'll also link in there to Trump Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry's article called America's Achilles Heel and Germany, which really forecasts these trends that we're now seeing far ahead of time. Thanks very much for that, Richard. For the next story, we'll take a look at Russia, where the government has justified a military coup in the nation of Myanmar and is now arming those who perpetrated the coup and is shielding them from punishment. For this, we'll go back to Rafaro.
Yes, like you said, Myanmar's military ended the nation's experiment with partial democracy at the beginning of February by seizing power from its democratically elected leaders. And ever since, it's been in a state of chaos. Citizens took to the streets to protest everything to do with the military takeover. But as a result, security forces responded by killing nearly 900 people. Because of this, most Western countries have shunned Myanmar. They've placed it under sanctions, but not Russia. Just at the beginning of the week, Myanmar's military leader landed in Russia for a security conference, and this conference that they had, Myanmar's leader was invited personally by Russia's defense minister. In fact, he was met by the minister at the very airport itself. Now, Russia has been a big time arms supplier to Myanmar for the last couple of decades now. It's only been behind China. In fact, from 1998 to 2018, 39% of Myanmar's arms imports came from Russia. But this latest instance of continued arms support is really significant, because you're giving these arms and this support to a nation that's been condemned, to a military that's been condemned for its violence against its own people. And Russia is continuing to meet with the military leaders in Myanmar, inviting them over for more arms deals and for more and fresher procurements. Just last month, Myanmar's Air Force commander attended Russia's top helicopter exhibition, and he discussed getting more arms there. But now this latest trip, this newest trip, it's even more significant, because it came just a couple of days after the United Nations General Assembly called on its member states to prevent the flow of arms into Myanmar. It actually got approved as a resolution by 119 member states of the United Nations. And only one country voted against it. That was Belarus, which is a well-known lackey to the Russian Federation. And it also sells weapons to Myanmar. But this resolution, a lot of human rights activists were thrilled and overjoyed that this could be the start of the end of the terrible situation that is in Myanmar because of this military junta that's in charge there. One of them, Tom Andrews, he said that it sets the perfect stage for the United Nations Security Council, which is the smaller but more powerful body of the UN in terms of policy. He said that now it would be able to take action, take real solid action and impose an arms embargo on Myanmar, impose stricter sanctions and more measures to hold the junta accountable. But Russia, even though it didn't vote for or against this resolution by the UN, it abstained. It didn't say anything, right? And then just a couple of days later, it sent a clear message of where its allegiances lie by inviting the leader of Myanmar's military junta into Russia. See, that just shows that even though it didn't vote against the resolution, it's not going to be adhering to it by any means. It likely won't support any such arms embargoes and measures against Myanmar. It's likely going to be arming this violent regime even more as we go ahead.
So what can you tell us about why the Russians are provoking the ire of the international community in order to protect Myanmar's junta? You know, what's in this for Russia?
Right. Yeah, a few analysts have written on it, and we've also written on it several times here at the Trumpet as well, that Myanmar is very strategically significant to Russia. It sits at a really really important position there in Southeast Asia, and it actually connects East Asia with Southeast Asia and the rest of Asia, that for the transit of goods and other valuable resources in the region, it would really give Russia a lot of access to the entirety of Asia. And a couple of analysts actually wrote about the fact that Russia's support for Myanmar's military government is driven by the desire to keep lucrative military contracts and also gain an important foothold in the Indian Ocean. And Russia sees itself as a global power. See, it wants to have a strategic presence not only around Eurasia, but in Southeast Asia as well. And Myanmar is really crucial for it to expand its power and to broaden its power in those areas. And you can see its influence in that region already, because of the 36 nations that abstained from voting for the UN resolution, a large number of them were Russian allies. China was right there in there with the nations that abstained from the vote. There were also 5 of Myanmar's 10 neighbors right there in Southeast Asia that also refused to vote for that resolution, to vote in support of that resolution. So you can already see the influence that Russia has already, and it wants to gain an even stronger foothold. And so it doesn't really care about the fact that it's supporting a violent regime. It wants to grow in its influence and its power there in Asia and become even more of a significant player on the global scene.
Rifaro has a new article about this that'll be going up on thetrumpet.com soon. It's called Russia Defies UN in Support of Myanmar. So please keep an eye out for that. And then we will also include a link in our show notes to the booklet by Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury. It's called The Prophesied Prince of Russia. And it really explains the prophetic significance of everything that Rifaro has been describing here. Russia's increasing influence and control over various nations throughout Asia. So please pick up your free copy of The Prophesied Prince of Russia if you don't yet have one. Well, thanks very much for that, Rifaro. We'll head back over to the U.S. now, where the Federal Reserve is considering plans to launch a digital dollar. To tell us about this, we'll go back to Andrew.
Yeah, digital currencies are becoming more and more popular around the world. I mean, you've got currencies like Bitcoin and Diem that are private digital currencies that I'm sure all of our listeners have heard a bit about. And now you've got big like central banks like China getting in the game and trying to head off these private cryptocurrencies at the pass by establishing a central bank-backed digital yuan. Well, now the Federal Reserve is looking to get on the action and jump on the bandwagon with Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell announcing that the United States is putting together a proposal for a digital dollar, also kind of colloquially called Fedcoin. Now, this digital dollar they're proposing, it would still be worth $1. But it would have no cash equivalent. It would be held in a digital wallet, either stored on your iPhone or on the internet. It would transfer the money digitally, kind of similar to a debit card, but with no cash equivalent whatsoever. And the point of it, as I mentioned, is to like really give people who are looking at Bitcoin or some of these other things an alternative instead of like not using dollars to use this instead. But it could definitely have some huge implications worldwide on the financial system. Now, I've got an article we'll put on online that we'll put in the show notes entitled Federal Reserve Mulls Digital Dollar that really brings out the point that, the United States right now, the dollar is the reserve currency, which is a huge advantage to it because it allows, it basically having the reserve currency allows America to run up astronomical debts and still keep the interest rates on that debt low. Normally, like I said, anyone with a bad credit score would, or who knows someone with a bad credit score would know that if your debt level's high and your credit score is bad, you have to pay a lot of interest. It's the same with nations, but America gets around that by having the dollar as the reserve currency. Pretty much every central bank and financial institution in the world holds dollars in reserve because it needs them to conduct international trade. But if you move over to a digital dollar and then a digital euro and a digital yuan, it makes it just that much easier to do international trade with digital transactions. You don't necessarily need a vault full of dollars someplace, and it really lessens the dollar's reserve currency status. And so this move that the world's going through towards digital currencies could really threaten America's position as the dollar's position as a digital currency, which could have huge implications for America's financial downfall, which is something that we at the Trumpet have been and our predecessor, The Plain Truth, have been predicting for decades based on verses like Isaiah 23 that talks about an international economic siege against America and Deuteronomy 28 that talks about high levels of debt being one of the curses that God puts on a nation that rebels against his law.
Andrew's article, once again, is called Federal Reserve Mulls Digital Dollar. We will link to that in our show notes. And we'll also link in our show notes today to Mr. Gerald Fleury's two books, Isaiah's End Time Vision and Ezekiel, the End Time Prophet, which really give a lot of detail about the scriptures that Andrew was just discussing there. So please order your free copies of those if you don't yet have them. Well, thanks very much for that, Andrew. And for our final story of the show today, we're going to take a look at Libya, where the situation has improved significantly in recent months with a ceasefire now in place and the oil shutdown lifted, but the underlying causes of the conflict have not been addressed, and there's much to be done toward that end. To bring us up to speed on this, we'll go once again to Mihailo.
On June 23rd, the German government hosted a conference in Berlin on to figure out the situation in Libya. It was at the invitation of German Foreign Minister Heiko Maas and the United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres. It involved countries like most of the major powers, like the United States, UK, France, Italy, Egypt, Russia, like a lot of countries in the Muslim world. It was there was another similar conference that happened in Berlin last year. Back then, Libya was mired in civil war. You had the UN-recognized government in Tripoli and the rogue warlord Khalifa Haftar trying to assault Tripoli and control large parts of the country. Now the dust has settled a little bit. The two sides have gotten together and formed a new unity government under Prime Minister Abdelhamid Dbeibah. But there's still a lot of problems going on in Libya, and the conference was organized to figure out how exactly to fix them. Mainly, and especially from the German position, it was the issue of foreign mercenaries in Libya. Turkey, under Islamist strongman Recep Tayyip Erdogan, he sponsored the UN-backed government, while Haftar and his militia was sponsored by the Wagner Group, which is a Russian private mercenary group with murky dealings with other powers. Some people say that it's basically Putin's private army to involve Russian soldiers without involving Russia itself. The U.S. intelligence actually said that the UAE was the ones who were funding the Wagner Group, and specifically in Libya. The UAE's denied that. We don't know for sure. But all these groups, Turkey, the UAE, Russia, they were involved in the Berlin conference, as well as the Libyan crisis. And the part of the organizations and countries at the conference agreed to was that the foreign fighters need to get out. Now, that's what Turkey and Russia are saying. In practical terms, are they going to be that eager to get their militaries out of Libya? Probably not. But it certainly shows that countries like Germany, who sponsored this conference in the first place, they're getting very interested and agitated at foreign involvement in Libya and foreign influence. And assuming Russia and Turkey and the UAE, all these countries do leave, well, who's going to fill the void? And the Trumpet has repeatedly talked about Iran coming in and filling the void, sucking Libya into its radical Islamist camp. I mentioned in the earlier segment about Daniel 11 and the prophecy there. Verse 44 specifically labels a bunch of African countries that are in the camp of the King of the South: Egypt, Ethiopia, and for our purposes, most importantly, Libya. And, of course, it's going to be the King of the North that smashes the King of the South, including its African proxies. So already we're seeing Germany look at the situation in Libya, even though the dust has settled from the latest civil war, with unease about foreign involvement and sponsorship. And we can expect a lot more of that to come in the near future. We actually have a booklet on this, Libya and Ethiopia in Prophecy, and puts it in really good context.
Well, thanks very much for that, Mihailo. We will include a link in our show notes to the free booklet that Mihailo just mentioned there, Libya and Ethiopia in Prophecy. Or you can find that booklet, along with all the other literature that we've mentioned on today's episode, at thetrumpet.com. So please visit thetrumpet.com for more on all these important stories that we've discussed today. Well, we are coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Please email any questions or comments you may have about today's episode to letters@thetrumpet.com. And thanks very much to our panel, Andrew Miller, Rafaro Manyepa, Richard Palmer, and Mihailo Zekic. And we'll leave you today with these words from Thomas Sowell. The first lesson of economics is scarcity. There's never enough of anything to satisfy all those who want it. The first lesson of politics is to disregard the first lesson of economics. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.